All right, so we are here to talk about Red Dog, which is now...
Windows Azure.
Okay, and so tell me about it. What is it exactly, anyway?
So Windows Azure is an operating system for the cloud. Hmm. It does, for a cloud of computers, a cloud of servers, exactly what an operating system does for a desktop. So let me give you an analogy,
sure.
Right? Suppose I told you, you're at a company, I gave you some money, I said, go spend 2 months and write for me a new version of Excel, a new spreadsheet that people can use on their desktop computers. Mm-hmm. Now, suppose I told you that the way you have to do this is, you're going to go to Fry's, you're going to buy a hard drive. Mm-hmm. You go somewhere else, you buy a motherboard. Mm-hmm. You go somewhere else, you buy network cables. Mm-hmm. You come home, you put these things all together, you try to build yourself a computer. Tomorrow, the hard drive goes bad, so you go back to Fry's and get another one. This time you actually come back with three of them because the next day you don't want to go back again. So now you've got this PC you've sort of assembled that works some of the time. Now you don't know where to put your data, so you've got to create a file system. You find that in doing this Excel, you have to do three different computations that you have to run at the same time in the PC. So you say, I need a process scheduler, I need a job scheduler, you go write that. Mm-hmm. You want to hook in some USB thing, you need to go find a device driver. You do all this stuff, and at the end of 2 months, your manager comes back to you and says, where's Excel? And you don't have it yet, because you spend all your time doing this other stuff, and you couldn't actually build Excel. Mm-hmm. Well, if you think about what is happening in the services world today, if you think about what everybody, whether at Microsoft or anywhere, goes through in the process of building a service on the web that a lot of people hit and use, they're actually living this exact nightmare over and over again. Right, this is literally what you're doing in the services world, because you start with the data center, you go find some switches, you go find some servers, you hook them up together, you have to figure out how to put your bits there, how to run them, where do you get a durable store in the cloud, mm-hmm. you have to go invent all this stuff again. And really, if you go back and look at the, you know, the blogs and the stories that have been told from people who've done this mm-hmm. Outside, all the stories that we heard and experienced ourselves at Microsoft, everybody has gone through exactly the same pattern. So we did this exercise, and we decided to basically step back and think about what is really missing here, right? What's the thing that should exist that should be common to all these people so they don't have to go through this problem? And the thing that struck us immediately was, what does an operating system do for your desktop computer? This is exactly what it does. It abstracts away all the hardware, right?
Yes.
You don't worry about that. It gives you device drivers for everything. Mm-hmm. It gives you a shared file system. You've got access control, permissions. You just use it. Mm-hmm. It gives you a process manager, a job scheduler, so you can... It's multitasking. You can fire up many things. They all run. Mm-hmm. How do you run a program on an operating system? You don't take an .exe and say, put it on that hex address, load it from there, start it from there. Mm-hmm. You just type in the name of that .exe and... hit enter, and it runs. There's a loader that figures out which actual part of the memory to put it on and run, right? When your program runs out of main memory, what happens? It doesn't just stop. It's not like the old days where there was a core, right? There's a memory system that swaps in and uses virtual memory, etc. So these are the things that an operating system does for you, and what we realized is that's exactly what is missing in the cloud. And many people have actually done, I would say, really great work on building individual components or pieces that have helped people get ahead on the web. I mean, a great example that I always use is Memcached, which is this very nice distributed cache that was built as a layer on top of a database. So if you're doing a lot of reads and just a few writes to a database, you put this little cache on top of it. And many people have had success using it. I mean, there's been many individual components like that that people have patched together. But I think what's been missing is this one cohesive operating system that you can just go use. So that's what we chose to build.
Wow.
And it's called Windows Azure because it is based on Windows. Mm-hmm. And we think it's an operating system for the cloud. So Windows is a good name.
That's amazing. It's just a little bit hard to visualize in the sense that when you're on your desktop and you run an application, you know, shell execute, whatever. But in the cloud, you're going to have, we're talking about, you know, we could have thousands of servers that this,
right.
that essentially this OS needs to abstract away.
Right. Right.
So could you talk a little bit about, like, the,
sure.
what's going on?
Sure. And if it, I'll actually draw a little diagram for
beautiful.
You on the whiteboard, if that'll help too. So there's multiple different things this OS needs to do, and the most basic thing it needs to do, as you said, is it's got this pool of servers, mm-hmm. this distributed pool of servers, and somehow it needs to coordinate all of them and decide what to do, right? So let me draw a little picture for you of how this works, right? So imagine you've got this pool of many different servers that are sitting on your cloud. So what we do is we put them all into a pool. Just like on a desktop, you have a pool of hardware resources, you have a pool of memory, whatever. In this pool, we put in this thing which we call the fabric controller. Mm-hmm. So the fabric controller is basically your resource allocator for this entire pool of machines. On every machine, we put in a thing called an agent. This is a little piece of code that we've got, and every machine has got one of these. And the fabric controller and the agent are continuously talking to each other. They're pulling each other. The fabric is asking the agent, are you alive? Are you alive? Are you good? And on every box here with the agent, we have the ability to put a piece of user code. So what you do is you basically go off and you write your application. So you write your app somewhere, and you write your application, and then you write another piece of specification that we call a service model. You write these two things, and you send them into the fabric controller. Now, the application is just your code, your ASP.NET code, whatever. It's a website. It's a worker thing running. The service model basically gives instructions to this fabric controller, and it gives these instructions in a logical way. Like it says, when my service runs, it has a certain topology. It has a front end that takes web requests. I want 20 of those. I want them behind a load balancer. Mm-hmm. I have a back end. I want 15 of those, and they should be doing some round-robin communication. Mm-hmm. So there's a way of specifying that in the model. That is fed to the fabric controller. What the fabric controller does is it looks at its pool of machines. It's one shared pool of machines. It knows how many of different kinds of machines it's got available. From the service model, it knows what your requirements are. And it does this sort of mapping. And it sees where can it fit you in? Where can it slot you in? Mm-hmm. And then it allocates those machines, those virtual machines, what have you, switches, routers, etc., to you. And then takes your code and places them in all those places, and then it starts it up. So in all these machines, it'll put some piece of your user code. So imagine that there's a machine here that it's using as one of your front-end boxes. So it's put the piece of code that you gave it, that was your ASP.NET for your front-end. Mm-hmm. It's put it there. This agent over here was given the instruction from the fabric controller saying, go start this piece of code. Bring it up, establish the ports, etc. That happens. There's a separate piece of code that takes a load balancer, wires it up, connects it to a bunch of machines. Now your code is up and running, and we generate for you a VIP, which is then fed back to you, and that's what you can use for other people to come and hit your service. Once your service is actually running, that's when the fun really begins. So, because your program can crash, it can have failures, all kinds of things can happen. So the agent is continuously polling your code. To see if it's still up and running, is it healthy? If it's not healthy, it goes through a whole state machine of actions. It can restart your code. It can move it to another place on the machine. It can move it to a different VM. It can actually move it to a different machine if this machine's gone bad. And so the agent's job is to keep that piece of your code running. Meanwhile, the fabric controller itself is also continuously talking to this agent because this whole machine might die and disappear, right? In which case, the fabric is not going to get a heartbeat back from this agent, and the fabric controller will know this machine is bad. Once that happens, this guy goes through his own state machine. The fabric controller has basically decided this machine's not behaving, so it'll go through a series of actions to try to fix this machine. It'll reboot it, reinstall the OS on it, etc. Mm-hmm. And if the machine is really a lost cause, then it'll be marked specially for some removal. Person to go and fix. Removal, right? Yeah. And then the fabric will issue a command to create another machine and spin that up instead, right? Just one point I want to make about the removal, since you mentioned that. We actually have an elaborate process in our data center where once a machine is marked for removal, we actually pull those disks out, we demagnetize them. There's a thorough security process we follow to wipe the disk before it goes out of the data center. Because we do know that it's customers' code and customers' data that is sitting on these boxes, and the last thing we want to do is compromise any of that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the general architecture of the fabric controller and how it manages this pool of machines. Now, the other interesting part of this story, so let me draw another diagram. Please. Let me erase this and draw another diagram. How do these services actually work? So you draw basically a picture which looks something like this. You say, my service is, I've got a load balancer, and then behind it, I'm going to have this role. Let me just call it a front end. This is, you can think of it as one piece of code, like maybe your ASP.NET for your front end of your web service. And you know what? I'm going to have many copies of this because this is going to be a scalable application. When one copy fails, I need to be able to handle through another one, and I need to have the load balancer be able to feed the requests to many different front ends. Maybe I've got another piece of code that is like my back-end code, which is doing some kind of job processing. It's producing thumbnails, etc. And I'm going to have several copies of this as well, maybe a different number of copies, so I said M. And now I need some storage. So I've got a storage system as part of this operating system. The storage system gives you things like tables, queues, gives you blobs, which are the really large-scale files like videos, photos. Mm-hmm. You can think of this as just one big bus that is out there in the cloud in our data center that's available to you, and anybody can talk to this, right? Mm-hmm. So what I've just done is I've built myself a service model for the Windows Azure Fabric Controller, and what I've said is, please deploy and start up for me a service that looks like this. And what I have to do as the service developer with this picture is I have to give Windows Azure the code that I'm going to run in the front end row, the code that I'm going to run in the back end row, how many of each I want, so the values of N and M, and I just press go.
Wow.
And the service gets deployed. We take all the bits. The Fabric Controller finds available machines. It finds machines that have the characteristics you desire. So, for instance, you get to say, this piece of code is CPU heavy and disk light. This other piece of code is really disk heavy, but you can put it on a box with a slow CPU, and it doesn't really matter to me. So it does all that allocation, lays it out, brings all these roles up, checks their health to make sure they're all healthy, and then gives you a signal back saying, you're deployed, you're ready to go, here's the whip for your load balancer, go have fun, hit your service, you're up and running.
Right?
So that's one part of it. Now the second part of it is, what happens once your service is actually up and running? That's when the fun really begins, because things start to go wrong. Hardware fails, software fails, etc. So what this system does for you is, because it's constantly monitoring all these roles, we can come in and fix things up behind the covers. So for instance, suppose you said that you wanted three of these, and at some point in time, one of these fails. You know, the hardware fails, something. Well, we have your service model. We have the code that you wanted deployed on each of these. So we can just go spin another one over here. We can put exactly the same code on it. We can start it up, make sure it's healthy. And then we reprogram the load balancer so that instead of connecting to this one, it connects to the new one. And it's a completely transparent change as far as users of the service are concerned. So that just happens. Because of this mechanism, you can also dynamically grow and shrink your service as it's running in the cloud. This is how you scale up and down. You can go and you deployed it with three, and you can decide that, actually, I want 30. All you do is you go and you replace three with 30, hit go, and you've got 10 times the scale. And literally in a matter of minutes and sometimes seconds, these things will get spun up, rewired, and you're ready to go. And it's a transparent change. The other thing we can do as part of this whole system is that we can help you upgrade your service without actually taking it down. So what we call a live upgrade. So imagine that you have three different copies of this front end running. Now, in order to do a live upgrade, what you want to make sure is that you don't actually take all three of these down at the same time in order to refresh the bits. So we put these things in separate slots that we call update domains. And we go through and roll this upgrade through your service one update domain at a time. So we take one down, we fix the code, bring it up. Then we take the next one down, fix the code, bring it up, so on.
Amazing. Right?
So we have that concept too. And the point I'm trying to make is that once you step back and take this operating system approach and you build this logical view of the world, it opens up a wide range of possibilities. I give you the example of the update domain, right? Another possibility is it becomes easy for Windows Azure to keep your OS up to date. Imagine that you didn't have a system like this. Every so often, when security patches are released for whichever operating system you're using, you have to go update every operating system.
Absolutely.
Right, on every machine.
Downtime.
Downtime, right? Sure. Now, because of this, we can use exactly the same system we use for when the developer wants to update their service. We can use exactly the same mechanism when we want to update the operating system underneath, like the OS that's actually running in every box, because we have these update domains, so we can take one down, update the OS, move on, next one, and so on. We can roll this whole thing through. Right?
Very nice.
So, yeah, so that's a little picture of how things sort of work in the data center.
That's great. Windows Azure.
Windows Azure.
That's very cool. Now, one of the things that a classic modern operating system does that runs on someone's desktop is managing resource allocation.
Right.
And for the most part, ensuring that applications can't consume all resources and that there's some sort of,
Isolation.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
What's your isolation model?
Right. So that's a great question. So what we've actually got a spectrum of models. I'll explain them all to you. But the one that we are launching our system with now, that we have just launched with in what we call the technical preview, is basically a system where we split servers up into VMs, virtual machines, and we've done a few VMs per server with the idea that all your code runs in a VM, and that comes with a guarantee. So you have a mental model of what's the computer, if you will, that I've got that is all mine. Mm-hmm. So we have a mental model in the tech preview that you've got basically one processor, which is a 1.9 gigahertz processor, and you've got 2 gigabytes of RAM, and you've got, I think, 160 gigabytes of disk, which is your own, contention-free. You're not sharing it with anyone. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's an isolated pool of resources just for you. Of course, the big pool of total servers and VMs is a shared pool, right?
Sure.
But once you get a slot in that, that slot is basically yours. I should stress one point that although we are using this VM as a mechanism of giving you that isolation, there's nothing you actually do in your service code that is specific to being in a VM. It's completely transparent. You just write your code. And the fact that it's running in a VM is just a mechanism we use to increase utilization and give you that isolation that you want. Yeah.
Now, of course, the big elephant of the day for programmers, less so I would argue for ASP.NET types, is parallelism and many-core. So let's talk about Windows Azure and writing code on Windows Azure for a many-core abstraction. So what I mean by that is even if I'm writing ASP.NET code, I might want to do plink queries on the server.
Yes.
How do you guys manage that?
Yeah. So so the way I would explain that is by saying, what's our take or philosophy on how you scale in the web, right? Yeah, and you're right, because what's going to happen is over time, the servers that are sitting in the data center are going to have more and more cores in them, right? And that's what's going to happen. So the way we think of it is the right model for computation in this world is basically it's stateless compute with scale out and a durable backing store underneath to actually keep stuff that needs to persist. So you write your code with the model that you've got many, 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 many pieces, copies of the same piece of code that are doing this, that you're forking all your requests, and they're doing the same work. They can come and go, they can fail, and as you want to scale up, you just do more and more of them. So the way that relates with the many core thing is that in our world, we give you a mental model of what is the capacity, what is the horsepower of one core. Mm-hmm. So you write one piece of code that tries to make effective use of one core.
Sure.
Right? How many transactions you want to handle per second or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then as many cores as there are, or as many servers as there are, we just spin up that many instances of the code for you. So it's another example, it's like a sometimes people refer to this as the shared nothing approach, if you will. You just scale out infinitely.
It's the same thing. It's what ASP.NET does.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's the same concept.
Right.
But, it could be interesting that if I passed you a front-end chunk of code, where inside of that code I express explicit parallelism.
Yes.
That I want you to take, rather than copy it all,
yes.
the same
yes.
thing everywhere,
yes.
just
yes.
take this pattern
yes.
and parallelize it for me,
yes.
bring it back, because maybe I want to increase the speed at which my
yes.
service
yes.
executes for my customers.
Yes. So I think of that actually as It's a complementary and orthogonal thing to what this setup is trying to do. You can certainly, you can definitely do that. And all the different rich mechanisms that Microsoft and others provide to exploit that kind of parallelism, you can still, you know, have at it and get the most out of that, right? So this is handling things at a different level of...
So before you continue, of course, we're so excited, at least I was really, you know, we're figuring out what the hell's going on here with this. That we didn't even introduce you.
Right.
So, come on, man. Who are you?
Okay, so my name is Manuvir Das. I know that's a pretty difficult name to pronounce. I'm actually a geek. I have a PhD in programming languages from the University of Wisconsin.
Cool.
So that's what I used to do for a living. I used to prove theorems before we got into a data center. And I've been at Microsoft for about 11 years now.
Excellent.
And been working on this project for a little bit. Worked on previous releases of Windows before that. Mm-hmm. Also had a brief career in Microsoft Research. Actually taught at a university.
Perfect.
So been through the whole spectrum of things. And now I work on this project. And what I do for this project basically is it's sort of my job to make sure it goes out the door. And it's the job of my team to make sure that we give developers something they can actually use.
Absolutely.
In terms of the APIs and the programming models and all of that. So so that's sort of my part of the story.
That's cool. I mean, it's very good to point out that, of course, this is a programmable. Just like Windows.
Yes.
Windows was developed pretty much from the beginning to be programmable.
Yes.
So, of course, this is the same concept.
In fact, I have a slide that I always use, which is, what are the four pillars of this operating system? What are the four things in there? And one of the four pillars is the developer experience. Because you're right, this is all about developers. Mm-hmm. This is all about the APIs that developers use to build their own applications. We want to do here, for the cloud, just what Windows did on the desktop for all those application writers who wrote their favorite application and offered it to other people. And part of the story for developers, actually, is we're making a very conscious effort with this operating system to not require people to make any specific choices, especially choices that are specific to Microsoft. Hmm. So, for instance, I used ASP.NET a couple of times as an example. There is no requirement in the system that you have to write your website that you host in this on ASP.NET. As we go forward, we will provide versions of this where you can do Ruby on Rails, you can do PHP, Python.
Nice.
You can, of course, use ASP.NET. You can use the .NET stack. We've done a lot of work for the developer where we've got this whole SDK, and we've integrated it with Visual Studio. But again, that interface is completely open, so you can plug in Eclipse. We've actually done a prototype where we've got an Eclipse framework that you use. Actually, it's an Eclipse framework that you use to develop C# code that you run with a service model in our data center.
Amazing.
So, and that's just a glimpse of where we'll be going. One point about that SDK, actually. We found that people have a difficult time making the transition from developing something on their desktop to moving into the cloud. Because in the cloud, the world is different and complex because it's distributed. It's got many copies of each thing, and there's different kinds of failures. So one of the first things we did in this project was we built a complete simulation environment for this cloud and data center that you can run on your desktop. So we call that the developer fabric. It's part of the SDK that is available for free that you can go download. Anybody can download. It's a very small download. You can install it. And it's got an integration with Visual Studio, although you don't have to do that. So what can you do with this development framework? You can create exactly this service model. You can say, I want 30 of those, 3 of those. You can hit go. On your desktop, it will actually spin up this whole service. It'll run it for you. There's a console you can watch. You can watch all the different instances running. You can see the spew coming out from all of them. You can watch the load balancer doing its thing. You can see all the different kinds of failures you get. There's a complete mock of this storage bus that I talked about with tables, queues, and bombs on your desktop. You can program to it. You can use it. And you can discover all the things that you would discover for the first time in the cloud. Like, imagine that you have two different front ends that are talking to the same table and doing writes to it. That creates some interesting challenges. You don't want to discover these challenges for the first time when you get to the cloud. You want to discover them right when you're writing your code. So with our SDK, you can actually do that, because you can deploy a faithful implementation of your system right at the desktop. So much so that when you're ready to deploy to the cloud, it's that exact same package of code that we run on the desktop that is actually shipped to this fabric controller that is sitting in the cloud, and it's running the same thing.
So let me try to get this straight. So, you know, if I go the Visual Studio route, and I'm only using that example because, well, that's what I use as a developer, because I work at Microsoft and happen to like the IDE. But for whatever I happen to be doing, I work in. So it's as simple as creating my environment, writing my code, you know, figuring out what my application is going to do, and then pressing a button that says deploy to Windows Azure or whatever your semantics are. F5.
Yes.
That's deploying to the cloud.
F5, and if you want to debug and step into the debugger, control F5.
Excellent. Right? So now you're saying I can use the debugger in the cloud.
No. So, okay, I was talking about the desktop environment.
Exactly.
This is what you do on the desktop.
Understood.
Now, the cloud is a different challenge because in the cloud, you want to be very careful about how you interfere with your running service because you've got live customers, they're doing live things. One of the goals of this platform is really to encourage best practices.
Sure.
So what is one of the best practices you use in the services world when you're really developing and running a service at scale? You do logging. You proactively dump information. And then you have really good tools to grab all those logs to, when things go wrong, to grep through the logs, if you will, and figure out what broke, to proactively run scripts to look for, you know, signs that something is going wrong, something is degrading, something bad is about to happen. That's sort of the model you follow. So in our cloud, today, in the technical preview, we do not offer you debugging in the cloud, but we offer you this logging. And we've got a whole system which not only there's a small set of APIs you can use to dump your logs. Mm-hmm. We give you plenty of space in your local disk in each of these pieces of code to actually dump your logs. And then we've got actually a whole system in the Fabric controller that grabs all those logs for you, stores them in a persistent location. You can go and ask for your logs and you can get them, and then you can do all kinds of analysis on your logs. One of the features that will be coming down the road that we've been working on with these logs is a system for end-to-end tracing. Nice. So imagine that you've got this website, photo sharing site, and you get a request from a customer that comes in here, and then you do some work over here, and then you send off another request to another machine which does some computation, and then another machine does something, and eventually the user didn't get a response back. So we've got a system where we can track that transaction for you as it goes through your entire network of machines. And when you get the logs, you can actually see that trace and you can navigate it. And you can correlate things. So you can correlate that something that went wrong in a computation in this box here was actually invoked because of a request that came in there. You can tie that whole thing together and see what thing.
Now, of course, you just used the T word, right? You used the transaction word.
Yes.
Now, down in that the bus.
Yes.
How does, you know, I imagine you're not, it's not SQL Server, right?
Correct.
So, you know, it's some custom thing that you guys have made.
Correct.
How do you deal with the notion of transactional processing?
Yes. So actually, this system is transactional. It has to be. Otherwise, we'd be in a little
in
bit
trouble.
Of trouble. Right. So there's, without getting into too many of the low-level details, what we've got here basically is we've got a system where we've replicated all the data. So we've replicated all the data three times for durability. Every piece of data has these three replicas. There's a master controller that knows where all the replicas of all the data is. And it basically does things like when one replica is lost for whatever reason, it goes off and proactively creates a fresh replica of that to maintain three replicas of each piece of data. That's also where we manage the transaction. So there's a system of locks, right? So there's a distributed locking system built in so that any piece of data, writes to it are protected, reads are protected from writes, right? So you have to grab the lock. The interesting related question to that is that all of these pieces of code, the way they talk to this system is through an API that is actually a REST API. Mm-hmm. And then here at the front gate, when we get those REST requests, that's where all of that work is happening, right? To acquire locks and pieces of data, et cetera. So it's not that in this code here, you don't have to actually worry about that. You just write your code, but the system underneath gives you those transaction guarantees and makes sure that the same piece of data is not being, you know, you don't have a conflict on the same piece of data by two writers at the same time.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I would, you know, I come from the web world, you know, also Windows. I worked in Windows for a while, but when it went to the web world, one of the things we did is sort of a complex deployment, right? Not all applications running on Windows Azure are going to be simple web pages.
Yes.
And so we had the notion, obviously, of a pre-deployment.
Yes.
Or, you know, something that's live out in the cloud, but it's not accessible because no one knows the URL, that I can then debug.
Yes.
Are you going to enable that sort of debugging experience in the future?
Yes, absolutely. I should stress that I drew some simple pictures here, and that's because this is the technical preview. The system is designed for very complex requirements, and I'll give you two examples of that. This storage system that we built, which we call cloud storage, as you can imagine, it's a pretty complex thing. It's a distributed storage system with replicas and everything. It itself is bootstrapped on this system. It is just described and implemented as one of these services and deployed by the fabric controller in our cloud. And that has been the case from day one. Mm. The second thing is, second point I wanted to make was that one of the reasons we actually built Windows Azure was because of all the learnings we had from the properties that we've done at Microsoft. Mm-hmm. You know, although we have hundreds of properties that we've done, services out on the web from Microsoft that get, you know, millions and actually billions of hits, right? And there's no way you can manage and deploy a system like that unless you go through the whole life cycle of production, pre-production, staging, integration, desktop development. So the system we've designed caters to all of that. And even at the technical preview, we're actually exposing this facility to users. And the way we're doing that is when you go to our web portal, which is the interface that you use to deploy your service, you get to deploy a production instance, you get to deploy a staging instance.
Excellent.
Each instance is a first-class service that is running in this cloud. It has its own VIP that you can hit. But only one of them, the production, is attached to the DNS name that you chose. Mm-hmm. And we give you a command, which is called a VIP swap. It's an atomic action. You invoke VIP swap and you'll flip the VIPs so that the same DNS is now hitting the staging version rather than the production. So this is a way of giving you this flavor of live upgrade and pre-production. Because what you do is you launch a service. It's the production one. You create your foobar.com and you link it to that. Now you want to make a change. You create a new version of your service. You deploy it in staging. You hit the same data store when you're comfortable. You test it, all of that. When you're ready to make it real, you just do the VIP swap. And your customer doesn't know the difference because the same DNS resolves, right? Mm-hmm. And you just go.
Excellent. Very exciting. So the other question that we have to address as we wind down.
Sure.
Is this is one part of a bigger puzzle.
Yes.
And, of course, Ray Ozzie had talked about this in his keynote.
Yes.
But, you know, how does this fit into things like live mesh?
Sure.
Right now, I noticed the way that you name things, your syntax, right?
Yes.
I've heard that before from the notion of fabric is the same notion that Ray uses for live mesh and the people over there. So I'm starting to see how things are connecting. Yes. So how does this relate to Zurich? Yes. SSDS, which is, you know, what I still call things by their code names. I'm sorry.
Yes.
You know, I work at Microsoft.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. And can I draw a little diagram for
you? Yes, of course.
I can just refresh Ray's diagram again and then talk about how these things all fit together. So down here we have Windows Azure, and then we have what you refer to as Zurich that we call .NET services. And then live services, which includes things like mesh, SQL services, which includes things like SSDS, and then down the road, SharePoint services and the like. And actually, this whole thing is called the Azure platform.
Nice.
So the way these whole things relate is, Windows Azure is, it's like that analog of the operating system in the desktop that I was talking about, right? You want to come and run something in this data center, this is what you go use. And it has all the APIs. So your first question was about Mesh. So Mesh is a higher-level service which is meant, you know, for users, sharing user data, sync, all those kinds of things. It's a higher-level service. It does have the roadmap here is for Mesh itself to run on Windows Azure like any custom application. Actually, we are well down that path already.
Nice.
And it's already the case that we have live data from Mesh, which is being held by the storage system down here in Windows Azure. So that's just a progression that will happen over time. SQL Services is really our database in the cloud, right? It's the premium storage offering. It costs a little more because it's like a database, but it gives you all the rich facilities, data warehousing, all of that. What we have down here in the storage from Windows Azure, it's more like your file system
exactly.
in the cloud, right? It's blobs. It's, yes, we've got tables, but these tables should not be confused with the database.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have joins and, you know.
It's a giant flat table, right?
It's essentially a giant flat table, heavily partitioned. You can have, you know, millions and millions of rows, and we spread them over, you know, thousands of servers, but really that's what it's for, right?
Mm-hmm.
.NET services is another set of higher-level services, which is basically allowing you to do richer scenarios. So one example is authentication, right? Everything in this level of the platform, Windows Azure, has authentication built in, of course. I mean, it's an operating system. So the file system has authentication. Any piece of data you touch, you have to have a key. But it's a primitive level of authentication. At this level here in .NET Services, we provide a whole system for access control and identity and federation of that. So this is where you can use Live ID to protect your data, you can use OpenID, you can use Active Directory. So imagine that you're building an enterprise service in the cloud mm-hmm. where you want all your, let's say, Boeing employees to access their payroll information. You probably want to take as credentials, not their Live ID, but whatever credentials they use in the corporate network, right? And so there's probably some Active Directory thing. So that kind of service is provided here,
nice.
Right? So this layer really here, you can think of as these are the sort of value add things that you can keep adding as you build up your application. And it's a rich set of different things you can combine. And this level down here, Windows Azure, is really, it's the essential things that you just have to have if you build a service in the cloud. It's hard to do without them.
Absolutely. It's the kernel, right? I mean, that's where the kernel lives.
People have used many different analogies, sure. But yeah, it's the stuff that you just...
You have to have, for example, if you're writing a Win32 application,
right.
which you could be up in that layer up
right.
there,
right.
you're not thinking about you know, the really low level plumbing,
right.
like the HAL
right.
and even you know the execution
right.
machine.
So the only tweak I would put on that analogy is that you don't typically go to CompUSA and buy a box that has the kernel on it, right? The box typically has more on it, right?
Of course.
Whereas in this world, Windows Azure is very much a box that you can go buy, except that it's in the cloud, so you don't actually go buy it,
sure.
right? It's a thing by itself that you can use
mm-hmm.
and do a lot with. And there's actually many, many services out on the web
mm-hmm.
that you could build just with this thing. It's meant to be complete enough
yeah.
that it has all the basics in there that you can just go. But we very strongly believe in this company that the things we're doing here really will make life easy for you, right? So if you think in terms of payoff, in terms of agility and time to market and how quickly can I get my service built,
yeah.
there's really two parts to that. What this layer is doing is it's helping you be agile by allowing you to avoid worrying about a whole bunch of things you used to worry about. And it's got a few essential critical pieces that make your life easy, like this file system. And then these things give you agility because there's all this functionality that's just knocked off for you one by one, and you can just go use it. And all these interfaces are open, right? There's no magic in the connections between these boxes, these boxes, these boxes. We haven't done some special hidden interface, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
These are all open interfaces, so it's mix and match. You can use some of these, some from somewhere else. It really doesn't matter. You can run in our data center, talk to things outside. You can be running outside, talk to any of these things inside. It's a completely open environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not meant to place you in a particular environment at all.
Very, very interesting. Wow. Well, hey, thank you for your time.
Sure thing.
I know you're really busy, and congratulations.
Thank you.
And we will come and talk to you more, probably dig in really deep into the Windows Azure layer. Of course, we can't get Cutler. He refuses to come on. But I'm willing to bet he was involved.
Yes, I can tell you that one of the key underpinnings here is what we did to the Windows operating system itself and the virtualization to make all this possible.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, his His hands are on it. Absolutely. I can say that.
Excellent. Well, great to meet you, Manavir.
Very nice meeting you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Very cool stuff.